Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, Cost of Compliance Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On June 29, 2015, the Supreme Court issued its decision in Michigan v. Environmental Protection Agency. The question in this case is whether the Environmental Protection Agency, or EPA, acted unreasonably when it did not consider the costs of compliance in determining whether it was appropriate to regulate hazardous air pollutants emitted by electrical utilities. In an opinion delivered by Justice Scalia, the court held by a vote of 5-4 that the EPA acted unreasonably when it treated the costs of compliance as irrelevant. The judgment of the D.C. Circuit was reversed and the case remanded. Chief Justice Roberts, as well as Justices Kennedy, Thomas, and Alito joined the opinion of the court. Justice Thomas filed a concurring opinion. Justice Kagan filed a dissenting opinion, which Justices Ginsburg, Breyer, and Sotomayor joined. To discuss the case, we have Andrew Grossman, who is an associate at the law firm Baker Hostetler. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Mr. Grossman.
This case, Michigan versus EPA, really comes down to and boils down to a single word, appropriate. But wow, it really takes a lot of statutory analysis and background to get there, as is frequently the case in administrative law and in particularly in environmental law. This case is really a waypoint, a stopping point in a 25-year-long regulatory saga that began with the Clean Air Act amendments of 1990. Now, don't worry, we're not going to go through the whole 25 years. But the key amendment that was enacted then was substantial changes to what's called the Section 112 program of the Clean Air Act, which regulates what are known as hazardous air pollutants, things like mercury and acid gases. The program requires the EPA to list source categories, in other words, categories of facilities, for example, power plants, that emit hazardous air pollutants, and then to set standards based on the absolute best performing facilities. Now, that's mandatory. It has to be done, and these are very stringent standards. It's one of the most stringent programs under the Clean Air Act. Congress, however, carved out a special exception for power plants. Before power plants could be regulated under this program, the EPA was required to determine that doing so was appropriate and necessary. And that's the subject of the case, Michigan versus EPA, and that's the subject of the court's decision, which ultimately struck down EPA's rule, finding that such regulation was appropriate and necessary. The initial finding, appropriate and necessary finding was made in 2000 in the final days of the Clinton administration. It was one of those midnight regulations, and years of litigation followed. Substantive regulations applying to power plants, however, didn't come out until 2011, until during the Obama administration. The Obama administration EPA recognized that this would be one of the most extraordinarily expensive rules that had ever been issued by the federal government. They estimated conservatively that costs would run somewhere around $10 billion per year. Those would be absorbed by utilities and obviously by utility customers, in other words, all energy consumers. Now, the benefits of reducing hazardous air pollutants, things like mercury from power plants, well, that was a little bit smaller. They estimated that was probably somewhere between $4 and $6 million per year. So cost, $10 billion per year. Direct benefits, somewhere in the order of $4 to $6 million per year. At the same time, they also expressed their opinion that there would be tens of billions of dollars worth of indirect benefits. Now, that might have been based on a somewhat questionable methodology, and it wasn't underlying their decision. But all of that was beside the point, because the agency, in determining whether it was appropriate and necessary to regulate power plants, decided that they weren't just going to put a thumb on the scale, they were going to put a brick. The agency found that regulation was appropriate simply because power plants emitted hazardous air pollutants and that those emissions wouldn't be addressed by any other Clean Air Act program. Costs, completely irrelevant. The word appropriate in the agency's view meant simply that you have these types of emissions, and that's it. Now, that's the decision that the Supreme Court was reviewing in this case, and the majority opinion was written by Justice Scalia, joined by the court's other four sort of conservatives, the Chief, Justice Thomas, Justice Kennedy, and Justice Alito. Traditionally, in cases involving interpretations of statutes, particularly in the Clean Air Act, The agencies are always enjoy the benefit of what's known as Chevron deference. When there is an ambiguity or a silence in the statute, the courts will usually allow the agency to win, to go forward with its reasonable interpretation of the statute. In other words, these types of decisions about, you know, where you are, where an agent, what types of policy decisions an agency can make within the bounds of the statutory text, those are decisions that can be made by the agencies, and the courts will give them deference to do that. And as the court points out here, appropriate is a very broad word. It's the type of word that, in the usual case, an agency would have enormous discretion to decide exactly what it means and to apply it in the appropriate manner. And the court recognizes that here, but it also recognizes that the agency did something very strange. As Justice Scalia explains in his opinion, one doesn't need to open up a dictionary in order to realize the capaciousness of this phrase. He writes, in particular, appropriate is the classic broad and all-encompassing term that naturally and traditionally includes consideration of all the relevant factors. And in this instance, EPA cut out of the equation what is one of the most obvious and straightforward and apparent factors, something that if you were going to consider in your mind's eye what would be appropriate regulation, well, certainly, cost would be a factor of that, in that. Justice Scalia's opinion also points out that the agency's interpretation, even on its own terms, doesn't really make any sense. In the agency's view, even if equipment that was necessary to reduce these emissions actually killed people, that still wouldn't be relevant. Those are costs, and they weren't going to consider costs. You could have pollution control technology that actually results in worse outcomes and worse environmental results, and in EPA's view, it wouldn't matter. As Justice Scalia explains, Chevron deference does allow agencies to choose among competing reasonable interpretations of a statute, but it does not license interpretive gerrymanders under which an agency keeps parts of a statutory context that it likes, looking at, say, health or the environment, while throwing out the parts that it does not, in other words, the parts that might refer to things like cost. The dissent was there's a dissent in this case written by Justice Kagan and joined by the court's other three liberals. And in Justice Kagan's view, the EPA did in fact consider costs, and that was sufficient. They just did it later in the regulatory process. As I described earlier, what was at issue here was this appropriate and necessary finding, which was the trigger then for these for the Section 112 regulations. And as she explains, EPA did think a little bit about cost when it was actually writing the regulations that would apply to the power plants. Once they decided to regulate, they had to consider what are called beyond-the-floor regulations. The types of standards that are at issue here have a floor. In other words, there's a statutory level that they have to be set at, and that an agency after that can consider costs to determine whether or not to impose more stringent regulations. And in Justice Kagan's view, in that aspect and in several other places that are similar, the agency did consider costs and, well, close enough. But there is, however, a problem with Justice Kagan's analysis. To begin with, this isn't exactly the interpretive approach that EPA took when it was writing this regulation. The agency, you know, specifically and deliberately decided that it would not take costs into account at this initial threshold stage, and it never talked about the idea that it would take costs into account at some later place and that was the reason it was adopting this particular interpretation. And it's a bedrock rule of administrative law that you have to hold the agency to its own explanation and its own reasoning for the actions that it undertook. The other problem with Justice Kagan's view is that she never really addresses the statutory text regarding appropriate. Presumably it means something. Presumably Congress had something in mind. And Justice Kagan's opinion doesn't really give it any meaning. Now, finally, there is a concurrence as well by Justice Thomas, and it restates his concerns about the constitutional legitimacy of the administrative state. Now, it's a particularly insightful opinion, but there's a portion of it I think that's worth recounting because it's almost like a skeleton key, both to the case and to its broader context. As Justice Thomas explains, agencies interpreting ambiguous statutes typically are actually not engaged in acts of interpretation at all. Statutory ambiguity is an implicit delegation of rulemaking authority, and the authority is used not to find the best meaning of the text, in other words, what we normally think of when we talk about interpretation, but to formulate legally binding rules to fill in gaps based on policy judgments made by the agency. He concludes that although the court holds today that EPA exceeded even the extremely permissive limits on agency power set by the court's precedents, the court should, in his words, nonetheless be alarmed that it felt sufficiently emboldened by those precedents to make the bid for deference that it did here. To put it differently, the agency was out on a limb, and it thought that it could get away with it based on the degree of deference that the court has given to it in prior cases. So what comes next? Well, there's actually an interesting wrinkle to the court's decision. Typically, when the court holds that a particular agency action is unlawful, the result is to vacate that action, to deprive it of any legal force or effect. But in this instance, the court did something very different. It remanded it back to the D.C. Circuit. In other words, sent the case back to the lower court. The D.C. Circuit has this practice that it typically follows in many cases known as remand without vacature. In appropriate cases where an agency has made some technical flaw in a rule or there's some problem with an agency action that can probably be corrected by the agency in relatively short order and in a straightforward way, the court will simply remand the matter to the agency, allow the agency to redo its homework effectively while leaving the rule in place. And there's good reason to believe that that's probably what will happen in this instance for a couple of reasons. First is that the bulk of costs to comply with this rule have already been spent. It was a 2001 rule. The deadline for compliance is coming up next year. And really, just about all the decisions that need to be made about major expenditures, what plants to retire, what ones to retrofit, many of those decisions have been made and they're being carried out right now. And so vacating the rule when the agency is likely to come back with another rule that looks just about the same would be something that would be very disruptive to the utility industry as well as to consumers and a variety of other people, parties that are interested. Also, there's kind of the statutory leniency that the majority decision gives to the agency. The majority doesn't tell the agency that it has to consider costs in a particular fashion, that it has to be particularly detailed about it, or even that it can't consider what it says are the indirect benefits of its rule. In the majority's view, these things may or may not be okay. It's hard to say. And that leaves open the possibility that the agency could simply, you know, write a few more lines, could compare a few more numbers, and in very short order could have a rule that satisfies the court's decision here. There's also the matter that the court never addressed the substance of the rule, in other words, the actual standards that apply to power plants. It simply wasn't an issue in the case. And so there's every reason to believe that if the rule is remanded to the agency and it makes whatever fixes it needs to make, that the substance of it is going to be exactly the same. And so for that reason, it's very likely that the rule will remain in effect. As a practical matter, it probably doesn't make much of a difference, at least in terms of if you're looking narrowly just at this particular rule. But I think it actually is going to have an enormous impact on future EPA actions. And it may well spell, I think, the doom of the Obama administration's climate agenda. And I think it's worth explaining why this may be. There are a couple different reasons. I think three are key. The first is, for the Supreme Court, although this seems like a very straightforward decision, simply applying Chevron deference to an ambiguous statute, determining that the agency went a little bit too far this time, the court's statutory interpretation is perhaps a little bit more aggressive than it has been in the past. Just because you're an agency and you get deference doesn't mean that you win. Even with the assumption that Congress intended to allow the agency to resolve ambiguities, and even with a broad and open-ended word like appropriate, the agency here still loses. In other words, the statutory text really does matter, and the court is going to try to give it meaning. You would think that these aren't particularly radical legal notions, but given the extreme deference that the court has shown in the past, this actually is an improvement. In some sense, it mirrors a little bit the Chief Justice's first step of his statutory interpretation in King v. Burwell, as was released just the other day. The Chief Justice's opinion explains in that case that IRS doesn't receive any deference for its interpretation of what are effectively healthcare-related provisions in the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act. Now, this opinion, Michigan, doesn't quite go that far, but it certainly does view a more limited ambit for the agency's authority. Then there's the question of the Obama administration's climate agenda. The absolute most significant rule on the horizon, and really the centerpiece of its climate change plan, was what the EPA calls the Clean Power Plan. There are two impacts of today's decision on the Clean Power Plan. One is direct, and the other is a little bit indirect, but possibly more important. The direct one is that the Clean Power Plan, the aim of it numerically is to reduce greenhouse gas emissions from power plants by about 30%, a very large amount, and in so doing to effectively begin phasing out coal. coal-based generation in the United States. It's likely to be an enormously expensive rule, and the agency, the EPA, intends to finalize it in late August. It's enormously controversial, and there are potentially many legal defects with it in a number of different respects. But one of the key ones is that in the statutory authority that the agency relies upon for this plan is actually an exclusion for types of facilities that are already covered by a Section 112 rule. In other words, just like the Mercury Rule. And so the fact that this rule remains in force, the fact that it wasn't vacated, and the fact that it's likely to remain in force means that that exclusion also continues in force. This is going to be a very difficult legal hurdle for the administration to overcome. But there's also something that is a little bit more, I think a little bit more abstract, but possibly more important. And that is the Clean Power Plan is structured so as to force states and utilities to make decisions and make investments as quickly as possible. Indeed, it hasn't even formally been finalized yet, and already investment decisions are being made, and it shifted a lot of money and spending and investment on the ground. That's the whole point. As Professor Michael Greva put it, once people make these decisions, there's no way to unscramble the omelet. That's why it's so important when these types of rules go forward that parties are able, in an appropriate case where there is legal uncertainty and legal doubt, to get a stay of the rule while its legality is litigated so that you don't wind up with the kind of circumstance you had here. And I think the majority's opinion, in a sort of between the lines way, does acknowledge that. When you look at the way that they dealt with this remand issue, when you look at their description of the cost and the unlawfulness of the rule, you get the sense that there's some frustration. The agency did something that was illegal here. Utilities and utility consumers had to spend tens of billions of dollars to comply with it. And at the end of the day, it was all illegal. The rule never should have had legal force in the form that EPA gave it. This is obviously not the kind of thing that the court wants to see happen again. And I think you can take today's decision as a shot across the bow to the D.C. Circuit, which tends to hear challenges to EPA rules, that when the next big rule comes down the pike, and we know it's going to be this Clean Power Plan rule, when that rule comes down the pike, put it on hold while the legal challenges move forward so that the courts have an opportunity to do their business and so that we don't wind up with another one of these awful situations where people spend billions and billions of dollars all for naught. That would be a major hurdle for the Obama climate change agenda. As I said, the Clean Power Plan is its centerpiece, and if the D.C. Circuit or even the Supreme Court does decide to stay that rule once it's finalized, that rule is unlikely to go into effect before the end of the Obama administration as litigation continues. And depending on the results of the 2016 election, that may actually spell the end of the rule. So you have here this most significant, the centerpiece, the key moving aspect of the Obama administration's climate change agenda. And if you look at today's decision, there's some reason to believe that it may well be doomed.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. For more episodes of SCOTUSCast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.